All right, guys, if you would open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 10, that's where the text falls today. You know, 1 Samuel, when we got to 1 Samuel, as we studied through it, we transitioned from God being their king to a man named Saul being their king. You know, I say that quite often, that God was their king, but we're going to read a verse today that says that very thing word for word. So I know I'm in good standings when I quote it. So we transition in 2 Samuel to David being the king. And David is a man after God's own heart. He's a good king in many ways. But we're nearing the end of his peak at being a just king, I guess. We're fixing to see several chinks in his armor, several flaws. And so when we look in 2 Samuel chapters 1 through chapters 10, we see what you could call the triumphs of David. David ascending to the throne. David conquering Jerusalem. David setting Jerusalem up as a capital city. You see David sending for the ark. David going to get the ark and bringing the ark to Jerusalem. David defeating the Philistines on two different occasions. He defeats the Moabites. And today we're going to read about his defeat of the Syrians. The kindness he extended to a cripple named Mephibosheth of the house of Saul. And today we're going to read about the kindness he extended toward the king of Ammon, a man named Hanun. But once we get into chapter 11, and this is sad. Once we close our books, or this Bible today, and we come back, the next time we open up, we're going to start seeing troubles for David. In chapters 11 and 12, we're going to have his affair with Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah, and the death of his son due to that union. We're going to have his son rape his daughter. We're going to have his other son murder his brother for raping his sister. We're going to have another son, Absalom, who attempts to dethrone David. And David's going to have to flee Jerusalem. And Absalom is going to be murdered. So you see troubles for David from this point on. So this is the last chapter I think we'll have for a while where we can just have confidence in knowing that, man, David's a great example. And David is a great example in many ways, but again, he's not the example. The example we have is Jesus Christ. You know, we could look to men like Moses, David, Peter. We could look to our Sunday school teachers in many ways. But we all stump our toe. We all trip and fall from time to time. But Jesus is the example. So, chapter 10, like I said, it isn't terribly hard to understand. But the events in chapter 10 are going to trigger, or they're going to cause a ripple effect that will transpire all the way through chapters 11 and 12. You know, and as we read chapter 10, some of these names may become familiar to you. You know, you may say, I think we've read about this before. And some of you may, well, this is the first time I've ever heard of that. But in chapter 8, we actually have some highlights or an outline of some of the kingdoms that David's going to conquer in chapter 8 of 2 Samuel. And we're reading the details in chapter 10. So some of these, how he puts to rest a man named Hadadezer, we read about that in chapter 8 also. But that was more of just an outline or a highlight. Today we're going to get the details. Again, in chapters 9 and 10, we see some of David's finest moments. In chapters 9, he extended kindness to a man named Mephibosheth, you know, of the house of Saul. A personal enemy. You know, Saul was a personal enemy of David. There was a long war between the house of David and the house of Saul. And in chapter 10, we're going to see David extend kindness toward a national enemy, the Ammonites. And the first thing that popped in my mind as I was looking over that is in Matthew 5. Matthew 5, 43, Jesus says, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say you should love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. David was good to people who wasn't always good to him in return. Now, although the Ammonites were enemies of Israel, the Ammonites the king of the Ammonites, a man named Nahash, seemed to have a good relationship with David. So let's read verses 1 and 2 in chapter 10. 2 Samuel chapter 10. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. And David said, I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, that his father has dealt loyally with me. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father. And David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites. So we see here the king of the Ammonites is a man named Nahash. And Nahash was he dealt kindly. That's the same word that's translated as kindly in chapters 9. But Nahash had dealt kindly with David. So naturally, as a teacher, what you want to do is, let's go see where he dealt kindly with David. Let's go back and read 1 Samuel. Let's go back and read 2 Samuel. See where this happened. How exactly did he deal kindly with David? Well, when you do that, you will strike out. We don't necessarily have any records of how Nahash was kind to David. We just know he was. But as you're looking at Nahash, what you're going to, the first and only reference we have to Nahash is in 1 Samuel chapter 11. So if you would turn there. 1 Samuel chapter 11. Like I said, this is when you're doing a study of Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, you find this, and then you see him again in 2 Samuel chapter 10. There's really nothing in between where it kind of can give us any hints as to how or why he was good to David. 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1. Then Nahash, the Ammonite, so we're talking about the same guy, went up and besieged Jabesh Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a treaty with us and we will serve you. You know, okay, so he went up and he besieged this city. And they say, look, okay, we'll serve you, we'll surrender, just make a treaty with us, just spare us. Nahash says in verse 2, but Nahash the Ammonite said to them, on this condition will I make a treaty with you, that I gouge out all your right eyes and thus bring disgrace upon all Israel. It's not a real good terms of peace, is it, to start with? But that's nonetheless, that's what Nahash, that was his terms to treat them as servants, to treat them as slaves, was to gouge out their right eyes, bring a disgrace upon all Israel. But they, what do they want? They said, look, verse 3, the elders of Jabesh said to them, give us 7 days respite. Give us 7 days to see if we can find anyone throughout all the territory of Israel. If there's no one to save us, we will give ourselves up to you. So they wanted 7 days to send messengers throughout all of Israel. For what? To see if someone would save them. You know, we don't see them crying out to God, do we? Not at all. We're going to send messengers throughout all of Israel to see if anyone will save us. If no one will save us, we'll let you gouge out our eye and we'll serve you. Never once do you see them crying out to God here. And this is the beginning of the we want a king to reign over us movement. This is the beginning of that. We actually see in chapter 12 of this very same book, 1 Samuel 12. 12:12. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. They didn't want God as their king. They didn't cry out to God to come save them. They wanted a man, and they cried out for a man. They sent word throughout all Israel to find a man who would come save them, and Saul answered the call. But see, they didn't want God reigning over them here in 1 Samuel. The people in Jesus' day didn't want Jesus reigning over them. You know, we will not have this man reign over us. And today, the natural man doesn't want God reigning over them either. So this is just depraved, natural people in action. But nonetheless, God gave them Saul. Saul delivered them. On that occasion, Saul had some wicked ways and the Lord tore the kingdom from Saul, gave it to David, and now David somehow had befriended this guy. Now, the events that happened in 1 Samuel happened before Saul was king. Saul was king 40 years. It's been about 15 years, give or take, after Saul's death is what we see in chapters 10 here of 2 Samuel. So this has been about 50 to 60 years after the fact. So Nahash is probably 75, 80 years old. So maybe he's mellowed out quite a bit in his old age and had befriended David when David was on the run with Saul. Most commentators think the reason Nahash befriended David was the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And since Nahash had battled with Saul so often, and Saul hated David, then I'll just befriend David. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. Logic. But as we get in chapter 10 of 2 Samuel, it says after this. So it seems to kind of fall chronologically right on the heels of Mephibosheth. As soon as David had been kind to Mephibosheth, after that, Nahash dies. And Nahash was also good to David, so David sent condolences to his son Hanun. He desires to deal kindly, to deal loyally with Hanun. And how was his kindness received? We see in the previous chapter, chapter 9, the kindness of Mephibosheth, how was it received? With humility, with joy. You know, Mephibosheth went so far to say, "Who am I that you should regard such a dead dog as I?" He even went on to say, "King, you can let them have everything. All the material blessings you've gave me, let them have it all. I'm just so glad that you're alive and you've come home safely and my Lord the King is on the throne." You know, Mephibosheth accepted or received the kindness of David with joy and humility. But here David's going to extend kindness toward an enemy of Israel, a man named Hanun. And the reception of this kindness is completely different than the reception that Mephibosheth received. I'll go on and read verse 3. "But the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun their lord, 'Do you think because David had sent comforters to you that he's honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out and to overthrow it?' So Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half the beard of each, and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips, and sent them away. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, 'Remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return.'" You know, verse 3 starts off with princes, "but the princes of the Ammonites." If you were to look down in verse 16, what's it say? It calls them commanders, where it says, "and Shabak, the commander of the army." That's the same word translated as princes up here. So to me, commander seems to make more sense. You know, these were his military advisors, for lack of better words. And the NIV actually translates it that way. "The Ammonite commanders said to Hanun their lord, 'Do you think David's honoring your father by sending envoys expressing sympathy?'" He's not doing that. This is these advisors giving this young King Hanun poor advice, by the way. And they said, look, they come to search out the city. And the name of the city is Rabbah. That was the capital city of the Ammonites. And this name, the name of the city of Rabbah, will pop up again in the next coming chapters. So kind of plug that in the back of your mind. And it said, to spy it out. Look, he's come, he sent them to the city to spy it out and to overthrow it. Now, these accusations were common in those days. You know, what did Joab accuse Abner of doing? You know, Joab accused Abner of the very thing back in 2 Samuel 3. "You know that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, and to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you're doing, David." You could even read back in Genesis 42. When Jacob sent his sons into Egypt to buy grain, Joseph recognized them. And it said Joseph accused his brothers of being spies, sent to spy out the land of Egypt. It's interesting, isn't it? But here, the kindness of David was viewed with suspicion. They question David's motives. I thought about this quite a bit. You know, unless you're God, you don't know someone else's heart. You know, we do need to be discerning, because there are people who were may lure young kids in by tactics that are not sincere. But we don't need to be so quick to tear down. You know, we are that. You know, I'm sure we all can name several men or women who, or couples who may do a good deed, and then the first thing you hear is, I wonder what their angle is. I wonder what they're up to. You know, we just, for some reason, something in us just can't accept generosity. Maybe it's because we know we're not generous, and therefore they got to be like us. Maybe that's what it is. But either way, now to be fair, I think these Hanun most likely has plans to expand his kingdom, like any young ruler would want to do. Probably like Nahash's father, who just was on a tear some 50 years ago trying to capture all these cities and gouge out their eyes. And now Hanun is going to take that to the next level. And he has these military advisors telling him what he really wants to hear. Well, this is the reason. This is going to be just the reason I need to go to war. But if he had really, honestly reasoned that these Israelites were sent by David not to pay their respects, he could have easily just kind of limited what they heard. He could have limited what they saw and just kind of, you know, yeah, just kind of got them on out of there. But he does more than that. You know, he actually embarrasses them. You know, he shaves their beard, cuts their garments off at the waist. That was nothing but sheer embarrassment. You know, think of, you know, in my mind, I guess like a hospital gown, which I know it's not cut in half, but it's open at the back and just being forced to walk through somewhere, the mall or school, how embarrassing that would be. That's what these men have here. But David, the way Hanun treats the ambassadors, it almost seems as if they're trying to provoke David. They're trying to pick a fight with David, and they get one. They definitely get one. In verse 5, it says, when it was told David, he sent to meet them. You know, this passage here in chapter 10 is also recorded in 1 Chronicles 19, and it says over there that David had sent messengers to meet them before the men were greatly ashamed. So David sent men or messengers to these men to kind of console them, and he tells them to just remain in Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. Now, when they had marched into Ammonite territory, they had crossed the Jordan and went over into Ammonite territory. And that's where they were humiliated. Their beards were shaven, their garments were cut in half, and they were embarrassed. David hears about it, and he sends men to them and tells them, just remain in Jericho. And I'm assuming Jericho at this time was just one of the first places they come to after they crossed the Jordan. You know, if we're reading through Joshua, that's one of the first cities. As soon as the men crossed the Jordan, that was the first city they come to. So they just kind of pulled into the next stop and just waited there for who knows how long. You know, with my beard, it would have took a year or two. Jacob could have left there in like 3 days. But anyway, so they were to stay there until their beard had grown and then to return. But one thing I want you to notice is that I don't know if there's anything to it, but the language is in here, and I know we're transitioning in the attitude of David. 7 times in 7 verses here, it's going to say David sent. You know, you don't really read that a whole lot up to this point. The phrase David sent seems to be more prominent over the next few chapters, and it actually is what gets him in trouble in chapter 11. I'm not saying it means anything. It just, you see David sent messengers to Hanun. David sent these men to meet the messengers, and we're even going to see in verse 7, when these men draw up for battle, it says David heard of it, and he sent Joab. So David seems to be in the sending mood here lately. All right, so these men have humiliated David, or David's men. They humiliated these ambassadors of Israel. And in verse 6, they saw that they had become a stench to David. They knew that this frustrated David. The Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, and the Syrians of Zobah and of Rehob and the men of Tob and Micah were by themselves in the open country. So the people of Ammon, they saw that they had become a stench to David. Did they apologize? I'm sorry, I just took some bad advice. I didn't mean to, David, I'm sorry. You don't see that. You see, what the first thing they do is they go hire somebody to come help them fight. It's almost, again, like they were trying to provoke a fight with David, in my opinion. So they go and they prepare for battle. It said the Ammonites sent and hired Syrians. If we were to read 1 Chronicles 19, it says they paid the Ammonites, paid the Syrians, 1,000 talents of silver to hire chariots and horsemen. And a talent is 75 pounds. So they basically give 75,000 pounds of silver to these Syrians for their aid to fight against the Israelites. You know, just today they say that may be as much as almost $20,000. I'm sorry, almost $20 million of silver they paid to have someone come fight their battles for them. And it said that they hired these men in chariots. And so that makes sense when it says that the people of Syria from Zobah, from Rehob, from Tob, and from Micah were in the open country. You know, with chariots, you need fields, you need pasture land, you need open country to actually be effective. And that's where these Syrians gathered. Now, the men of Ammon, they kind of staged themselves at the entrance of their city. They're at the gate. They're right there at the city gate. Now, when you get to verse 7, it's hard to really see. It says, when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. So was David really, when his men were humiliated, did David prepare for battle right then? It doesn't really read that way. I'm not saying he didn't. But it's almost as if his men were humiliated. David told him just to remain at Jericho, and David went back and was just kind of maybe seeking counsel from the Lord at this point. And then he saw them gathering up forces and fixing to attack, and that's when he sent Joab and all the mighty men. I don't know that David reacted, as soon as his men were humiliated. I don't know that, but I do know if we were to read 1 Samuel, when David and his men were humiliated by a man named Nabal, he reacted right then. And he was on his way to do harm to Nabal until Abigail intercedes for Nabal. So maybe David's learned his lesson. In this case, the Ammonites humiliate his ambassadors, and he just remains in Jericho, probably boiling inside, but seeking the Lord. But then when they gather armies and look like they're fixing to start a fight, David sends his men to engage them. So I'll read verses 9 through 14 here. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him in both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. And the rest of his men he put in charge of Abishai, his brother. And he arrayed them against the Ammonites. And he said, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what seems good to him. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. And Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. So we see here, as Joab gets there, he's got the Syrians in the field out here, and he's got the Ammonites right outside the city gate, and he seems to have them at the front and the rear. So if he turns and he fights the Ammonites with his full force, he's exposed. And if he turns and he fights the Syrians, he's exposed. So his only option at this point is to divide his army and to fight both fronts at the same time. Now, I think Joab here, when he takes the best of Israel, some of the best of these mighty men, which is the first time back in verse 7, it says David sent Joab and the host of the mighty men. That's the first time that they're referred to, you know, the 37 mighty men of David. This is the first time they're referred to in Scripture. So Joab takes the best of these men, and he goes and he fights the Syrians. He must have thought they were the strongest opponent, and he left Abishai, his brother, to fight the Ammonites. And before they go into battle, he gives them somewhat of a pep talk. You know, if they're too strong for me, I want you to come help me. And if they're too strong for you, I will come help you. And he says, but be of good courage and let us be courageous for our people in the city of God. And may the Lord do what seems good to him. Now, Joab, throughout this book here, hasn't really been, I guess, a religious figure. He hadn't been someone that you would get good theological teachings from. But here he says something very sound. May the Lord do what seems good to him. He had, at this point, prepared, and he was prepared to fight, but he was leaving the results to God. That's all we really can do. You know, we read of Daniel 3. You have the similar language in Daniel 3 with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, when Nebuchadnezzar has that golden image and he requires everyone to bow down to it, and they refuse to, and he calls them up front, and he says, look, if you don't bow down now, I'm going to cast you into the fiery furnace. And what God would be able to save you from that? He said, let it be known to you, O king, that whether you cast us in there or not, our God is able to deliver us from the fiery pit. But even if he doesn't, we will not bow down and serve your gods. That's all you can do. You know, you have Esther. When she goes before King Ahasuerus, you know, she goes before the king, and anyone who presents themselves before the king without being called in at this point, without being summoned, could be put to death. And she tells her uncle Mordecai, you know, fast and pray and tell the people, tomorrow I'm going to go in before the king. And if I perish, I perish. You know, there's several instances we can read where people prepare and work, prepare and fight and leave the results to God, because we're not judged on our results. The results are not up to us anyway. And that's what Joab says here. Look, we're fighting for the cities of our God. We're fighting for our people. And that's all we can do. Let the Lord see what seems good to him. That's all we can do. Leave the results to God. But anyway, it seems like there's not even no blood drawn. It seems like there's really not even a fight. It seems like the Syrians just fled before Joab. And when the Ammonites see the Syrians running, what do? They run back in the city. They fled before Abishai. They entered the city. So the Ammonites went back in the city, locked the gate. The Syrians just ran home. But they go home. At this point, Joab returns from fighting against the Ammonites. He returns to Jerusalem. And when he gets to Jerusalem in verse 15, the Syrians saw they had been defeated by Israel. So they gathered themselves together. They kind of regrouped. And Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam with Shabak, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, at their head. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. The Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him, and the Syrians fled before Israel. And David killed the Syrians, the men of 700 chariots, 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Shabak, the commander of their army, so that he died there. When all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. So the Syrians, who were paid, come to the rescue of the Ammonites. And then when they fled, because they were paid warriors, they didn't really care about the cause. So they ran, and when The Ammonites at this point knew that they were toast. They run back in the city, lock the gate. But when the Syrians come to battle David, the Ammonites don't go to help. They just stay locked in their city. But you see, verses 15 through 19, this is where it seems to be the only time David is fighting with his people. You know, I guess I could imply that he was in some of these other instances, but it doesn't say that. It just says David sent Joab. David sent the mighty men. But here, David's going with them, and he wins a great victory. You know, maybe the Ammonites, you know, who had stayed locked up in the safety of their city, Rabbah, thought we paid you to fight when they were thinking the Syrians, not us. Now, when we get into the next chapter, it says David sent Joab again, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. So this what happens with David and Bathsheba happens right on the heels of these Ammonites being locked in their city of Rabbah. And they go home for the winter, and they come out in the spring of the year to take the Ammonites for what the war they had started the year before. So all that happens with David and Bathsheba and Uriah and the whole thing in chapter 11 all really started back in chapter 10 when David sent messengers to Hanun, the son of Nahash, to just, I'm sorry for your loss. They misread that, humiliated them, and it started a fight. And this fight escalated into what we see in chapter 11. But you look at the people that are killed here in chapter 10, 40,000 horsemen, 7,000 chariots, over 40,000 people were killed on what seems to be a misunderstanding at the beginning. So it just makes you wonder, how many times have wars and divisions and battles and death been over nothing? This is a perfect example of making something out of nothing. I mean, there was nothing there. David, the scripture never even hints at the fact that David had anything except sincerity at heart. He was sincere when he sent these messengers to Hanun. Hanun made something out of nothing and caused a war that made his men servants to David, killed 40,000 Syrians, all for nothing. But I couldn't help but, as I read this, think about how the Lord God had sent His Son into, I guess, what we could call enemy territory. He sent His Son into this world to show kindness to us. And how was it received? Mocked, spit on, ridiculed, made fun of. You know, even the good things He did, they tore down. He would even say, you know, what good thing have I done that you seek to stone me? So, I guess it's easy to see how these people could get this way, and I pray that we have more of the heart and mind of Christ when we interact with others, that we don't necessarily tear them down as quickly as these people do, and as quickly as the Pharisees tore down not a good man, but the perfect man in Jesus Christ. And we'd have been right there along with them. But anyhow, there's not probably, there may be some more there that we just wasn't able to pull out, but nonetheless, it's a chapter that ends what seems to be David in his good days, and we're fixing to crack open next week and get into chapter 11, and we're going to see troubles for David for a while to come. So if you would, please stand. Collins, would you...